Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and what's next. It's a show that asks questions and peels back the layers of our average everyday experience and goes beyond scratching the surface. We interview people doing incredible things who are making a difference around the globe. Join me as we listen in and get one step closer to understanding that big ideas shared create collaboration, collaboration can inspire community, and communities create social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So I just got off the phone with Maureen Palmer. She's a filmmaker who used to work with the CBC and has gone out on her own and has a company now called Bountiful Films. Check them out online. But her new film, Wasted, is a really personal story. It's about her journey with her partner, Mike Pond, who is an alcoholic and came out of a book that they wrote together called Wasted, subtitled An Alcoholic Therapists Fight for Recovery in a Flawed Treatment System. It's going to air on CBC's Nature of Things soon with David Suzuki. It's turned into a website. It's turned into so much more than just a book and a film. It's going to have a life, I think, that's going to continue on for many, many years and going to help an awful lot of people. Please check out not only the podcast that's about to, the interview that you're about to hear, but check out the film. It's called Wasted. It's online soon, and the book will be released, I think, in the U.S. in February. So they're basically, I think, Maureen and Mike's ideas to take over the world when it comes to this kind of thing. So I wanted to wish them congratulations. Check it out. More interviews at davidpecklive.com, rabble.ca. You'll find some other interesting stuff there as well. And thanks for continuing to listen.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest today, Maureen Palmer from Bountiful Films. Thanks for joining us today, Maureen.
Thank you for having me.
So we're here to talk about, I think, a whole lot of things. We're here to talk about a film. We're here to talk about a book, your partner, maybe about addiction, mental health issues. Should I keep going, Maureen?
The list is endless, isn't it?
It really is. I just, you know, first of all, congratulations on the film, which is going to air on, I believe, on the 21st of January, 8 p.m., CBC Nature of Things.
Thank you.
Yeah, good. And make sure you check out Maureen's website, bountiful.ca. That's the film company. But there's also a book out there as well called Wasted, An Alcoholics Therapist's Fight for Recovery in a Flawed Treatment System. Wow. I mean, so, okay.
It's been quite the year.
No kidding. So give me some, can you connect a few dots here for me?
Sure. So I think you'll find out in the film, I met Mike on the dating website, Plenty of Fish. And he arrived and we met, he came on public transit and he ordered a cranberry and soda. And I thought, why isn't he drinking? His spidey senses were immediately tingling. We didn't get into that very much on the first date, but the second date, he spilled the beans. Not all of the beans, but enough to make me go, oh my God, this guy has such a story. You know, do I want to date him? Not sure, but I've got to find a way to tell him.
But damn it, I want to make a movie about him.
the movie was not really on my horizon.
Oh, okay.
So
interesting.
Cool. You know what? My partner at Bountiful Films, Helen Slinger, we took a few runs at both The Nature of Things and Doc Zone for CBC. We've always wanted to do something on alcoholism. Hmm. So we'd write our pitch and we'd go to the meetings and we'd say, alcoholism. Character flaw or chronic illness.
Right.
Different pitches, right? And always, for whatever reason, we got turned down. Then Mike and I wrote the book. Somebody gave the book to somebody at the CBC Documentary World. About the same time, I did phone The Nature of Things and say, hey, you know, when writing the book, we discovered a very personal story about addiction, but also that there's a revolution in research going on that's not translating into treatment yet.
Mm.
And people should know about that.
Hmm.
And that's when the Nature of Things went, that's the story we want.
Right. Which is what David Suzuki refers to several times throughout, is evidence-based treatment.
Yeah, you know, the vast majority of treatment, if you can call it that, in North America, is not evidence-based. Most treatment centers, I'd say about 90% of them, are 12-step oriented, and they're on a continuum from, you know, low-end, run-down recovery houses like the kind Mike ended up in, to, you know, $50,000, $60,000 a month places.
Mm.
Now, to be fair to the 12 steps, there is a growing, small evidence base for the 12 steps.
Right.
And the concern for us was there's a really strong body of evidence that says it really only works for about 30 to 40% of people. So what happens to the other 50 or 60%? Well, they're largely left to be feeling like failures because they can't make AA work for them. We saw the urgency for a dramatically expanded toolkit to treat addiction. And the reality is we discovered there are things out there that people don't know and, worst of all, doctors don't know.
Right. You know, it's really interesting, you know, something that sort of, I just come through some shoulder surgery a couple of months ago, 23-year-old injury, looks like it was a huge success, you know, 3 incisions and they go in with tubes and cameras and lights and, I mean, isn't it wonderful? And on one hand, you go, wow, this is incredible, this medical community we have here in the West, and yet I also suffer from some sleep issues. And I know the trouble that that has caused my doctors and myself getting to the bottom of that. And nobody's admitted that they can't fix it, really. And yet I've got half a dozen different doctors who have tried. And now what do I find? I don't know that it's actually making a huge difference, but I find yoga to be one of the most satisfying things that I do to sort of calm the mind, et cetera. And, you know, medication, CPAP machine, test after test, you know. So I wonder, did you guys find out this idea of these chronic illnesses, these chronic things? Is that where things are breaking down?
To a certain extent, I think that does play a role in this. I think the bigger issue is that in our society, and our doctors are a reflection of our society, I still think that there's a big feeling that this is a moral issue, not a medical one, which is kind of ironic because the American Medical Association and the Canadian Medical Association have both characterized alcoholism, as now called substance use disorder or alcohol use disorder, as a disease. But they don't treat it like a disease. We don't fund treatment for it. We don't give people compassionate, evidence-based care. We give them a tremendous amount of judgment. The other thing I think that's happening here is Alcoholics Anonymous has been wildly successful for good reason. It has saved millions of lives. It's also been a fabulously successful PR machine.
Right.
So that, you know, early in the days of AA, it actively cultivated relationships with judges, media, lawyers, doctors, power people in society. The ripple down effect of that is that still most doctors believe the go-to treatment for addiction is AA. And they insist their clients go, to the detriment of the client and perhaps to their own ignorance that they don't even go and look at what the options might be for new treatments.
So it's not necessarily I guess the thing that stands out to me, you know, it's not either or, right? I mean, it's not.
Yeah, it's not.
I wondered as I watched your film, which is wonderful, by the way. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
But I wondered, oh, geez, are they going to go the whole scientific route again and leave out relationship? Are they going to leave out, you know, the community-based care? You know, I love the way you just said, quote, compassionate, evidence-based care. It's a great phrase because, most of the doctors who spoke were, you know, they want to talk about research. They want to talk about numbers. They want to talk about evidence. Great.
Yeah.
Love it. Perfect. That's awesome. But where does the relational side kick in?
And when you say relational, are you talking about my relationship with Michael?
Well, partially, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he says at one point in the film, and I'll find the quote here somewhere, but he says at one point, I couldn't do it without you, right? The quote is, I never would have been able to do it alone. And
so
I think that's a really remarkable statement to make. And so I guess I mean, I don't know, community of friends, community of supporters, I guess you could say.
I think that, you know, on the downward spiral, Mike says, he uses the expression, severe alcoholics be people, right? You get to be somebody who can't be relied upon, who lies, who cheats, who steals.
Mm.
And so even though people know, I think a lot of people know on some level, that this is hijack reward circuitry in his brain doing this. It's not. It is not actually him wanting to do these things.
Right.
But I think it becomes very hard over time for people to forgive that. Like for Mike and I, it was brand new. I didn't have the history with him. I could see his integrity and his mental discipline. Like I've never met anybody more disciplined in my life, which really gives credence to the idea that, you know, he has discipline in every other way. Clearly, he can't use it to stop drinking, so that must be something else.
Right.
And I actually think, you know, we did rebuild his life together, and we had a good, solid relationship before the relapse came. And we were so lucky that the relapse came just when we were learning about community reinforcement and family training, or CRAFT.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the game changer in my mind. Like, I now know the more you shame and blame and humiliate and give shit to somebody who drinks again, the greater the chance that the relapse will become more serious.
Well, is there any good to be found in the whole idea of guilt and shame? I mean,
well, it's amazing, and you know, I think there's a couple of great experts in the film that say it's amazing. You know, if punishment worked, no one would be addicted.
Right.
That you know, we are very addicted to making people feel bad in our society. And you know what? It's kind of stupid because we're shooting ourselves in the foot. It is costing us as taxpayers more to perpetuate addiction. It's a $700 billion with a B problem in the U.S. alone annually.
Wow.
Yeah, tack on what it costs Canada. And that's, you know, in broken relationships, in healthcare costs, in social costs, criminal costs, court costs, all because we don't want to actually spend money on what we do for every other illness, which is preventative, swift action, evidence-based care.
So we got to talk about the relapse because it's just so interesting. I want to talk about that. I want to talk about the what the relationship must have been like as a filmmaker. This is your partner, the person you love. How bizarre that would be, you know, putting a camera on them. And this isn't just to tell us about, oh, I don't know, his beautiful craftsmanship as a furniture maker. No, you're going a little deeper, a little more intimate, a little more intimate than that. But for a second, before we go there, talk to me about why don't we want to see it for what it really is? Are we sort of shining a light into our own darkness in a way? Does that make sense?
Why don't we want to see
why
as a society we don't want
to see that? Why do we want to keep seeing it as a moral issue and not necessarily as a medical one? You know, that polarizing of
interesting. Really interesting question. I think because I think we are very conflicted in our society about alcohol, right? It's so intertwined into everything that we consider to be pleasurable in terms of celebrations.
Mm-hmm.
I think on some level, if we can perpetuate the dichotomy that those people are different from us,
right?
That they've made a conscious choice and, well, I don't have that choice, I don't have that problem, that somehow we're better than.
Yeah, well, see, this is where I was hoping you wouldn't go, but that's kind of what I expected the answer to be, because I think that seems to be the case, right? Don't we, we feel better when we're able to sort of look down, whether it's literally or metaphorically, on others.
I think so. I mean, who hasn't told stories the morning after a party like, oh, did you see so-and-so? She's so wasted, right?
That's right.
Everybody rolls their eyes. Oh, yeah, one of these days, you know, she's not going to get better until she hits rock bottom. I have said these horrible judgmental things myself about people. And I think it was so many levels. Mike's relapse was a huge learning opportunity and a very humbling experience.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. Really, You know, the night he drank, I thought, shit, wonder what's going to happen to the film. I wonder if the CBC will still want the film. Maybe they won't consider us to have the credibility to deliver it.
Right.
You know, all these questions went through my mind, and then I went, oh, well, if we are going to continue with the film, this is a key part now. What will I do?
Right.
We have to document this, even though we don't have to decide right now whether we're going to use it. And there was only one way to do it, which was, as it was the next evening, and Mike was sober by then, we both picked up our cell phones, our iPhones, and started talking to each other about it. And I said, honey, we don't need to use this. We don't know what we're going to do with it, but we need to capture it, because the anxiety and the emotion of right now will never be captured again.
Yeah.
Unless you do this again,
yeah.
You bonehead.
Yeah, that's right. You moron.
Yes.
Yes, capital M. So you're in the middle of the book. You've decided to make a film. You started to shoot. Mike's 5 years into recovery?
Five and a half years,
and has a relapse.
Yeah. And it was really spawned, I think. And one of the scientists who we interviewed said this, it's not in the film just because he ran out of time. When he had his motorcycle accident, he ended up in the ER, brought by ambulance. And that was the place that we calculated he went to 31 times on his downfall.
Wow.
Yeah, and each time, most often, he was treated quite with humiliation. And as you saw in the film, his ex-wife supported that, right? You know, if they were lucky, he was given an Ativan and a bus pass.
Ativan and off you go.
Yeah. Yeah, and here's a guy who had two life-threatening seizures during that period. But, you know, the feeling in ERs is just, well, these people are not really sick. We have more sick people than these people make a choice, right?
What, so pray tell, it good is it giving somebody Ativan, by the way? Which
well,
is
what
a
it does is
Temazepam family, right?
Yeah.
Highly addictive medications.
It is. Really good addiction doctors will say this in itself is problematic. In the short term, it diminishes that severe anxiety and jitters and all the stuff that can actually lead into a seizure. So in the short term, it's okay, but in the long term, it doesn't solve the problem.
Sure. Yeah.
And it may that whole experience in Mike's head, going back in as an injured person was triggering. He just came home and he went into the fridge and he opened up a bottle of wine and drank, and he hadn't, you know, he's poured me wine glasses. He had disinterest, especially in the last 3 or 4 years. So it was a real shock. I mean, it was absolutely stunned when I figured it out.
So up until this point, you had no sort of reason to believe that you were going to wind up here.
Oh no, I was totally smug.
Well, you mentioned that in the film, yes.
Yeah. You're doing great, buddy. I mean, this is awesome. This is never going to happen to us.
Yeah.
Yeah, I learned, and, you know, I just think, and I even before the relapse, we'd filmed a few of the experts, and they said, yeah, no, it's a chronic relapsing disorder. That's part of how we identify it. And still it didn't twig with me. Oh, yeah, this could happen to Mike. And Mike was terrified, you know, when it happened.
Yeah, no, it must have been, I mean, on so many levels, pretty terrifying, I would think.
He thought, first of all, that I was going to kick him out.
Of course.
Which is like the farthest thing from my brain. And that he was on that downward, very desperately lonely spiral again. We were so fortunate that we found a new treatment that works, and works incredibly well for him.
Okay, so now we're on another path here. I got to go down this road. So farthest from your brain. The idea of kicking him out. I bet up until that point, he hadn't experienced that kind of inclusion, that kind of an embrace.
No, and to be fair to his family, early in the process, they tried very hard to help him until they couldn't. And then it became, I think, an ever more fearful, desperate, anxious period in his family's life where they could see, I mean, he was their financial bedrock, right?
Right, yes, yep.
Mike and I are in a different situation. I'm already well established. I don't have any other dependents. And I think that I had learned, we'd started doing research on this craft, that if I could support him through this, not shame and blame him, maybe not even talk about it for, you know,
right,
the rest of the day until he feels better, and then he can bring it up. And, you know, I just learned to steel myself and say, whatever this is, Mike, we're going to have to go through this together.
What I love about this story is you don't tell much about your story, which I guess some filmmakers do and other documentarians mm-hmm. don't. You know, some sort of Errol Morris mm-hmm. sticks himself in the films. But
CBC made me.
Right. But I think what's interesting to me, you know, shame for me is a theme throughout this film. And maybe that's
true.
Just because of how it plays out in my own life or in my friends' lives or, you know, I see it in others and how my wife and I, Elizabeth, have so tried not to use that as a parental tool. And I think, you know, so many parents have and still do. And this idea of guilt and so on. And what's the damage that we're doing to one another and, frankly, to ourselves? So I think there's something there, Maureen. Why didn't you go there? Right? Why did you obviously love Mike unconditionally, and you've embraced him and included him in a way that's not based on his behavior, and that to me is fascinating.
Why didn't I go there? Because I'd heard really mostly from the experts that it doesn't work, and by then I'd already understood hijacked reward circuitry. Right? Like there was an element of what I understood about Mike's brain that truly he could not help it.
Right.
And he didn't plan to, you know, throw a bomb or a firecracker into our lives. And I really knew that if I did this, he could end up back in that place.
Mm.
And the burden of that on my conscience.
Right.
You know, knowing what I knew, based upon the research, couldn't go there. You know, my dad drank too, and this is actually a really good lesson for me. I would get mad at my dad. And my dad was a happy drinker, but he was a drinker.
Right.
And sometimes he would be a little bit, I think, belittling of my mom after he'd been drinking.
Interesting.
And I would be I would leave. I'd get in the car and leave the house, or if we're out at a restaurant, I'm not going to be, I was very judgmental about my dad. And I think it's almost like my dad's dead and he's teaching me something.
Right.
You know, like there is no shaming somebody into health. It never works. It doesn't work. You are probably about my age, and I think we all probably grew up in a very shame-based culture.
I think so too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder what damage it does to the soul, what the damage it does to our personalities, our ability to love others, our ability to include others. I mean, it's just kind of that circle, that spiral downwards just continues, right?
Yeah. Yeah, and I think even before I met Mike, I'd come to a place in my life where I didn't want to be unkind to anybody ever, especially my daughters, right? It was time to just, you know, these people are in your life and they're a great gift. And do you really want to spend 1 second where you make them feel bad?
Yeah.
And I think that I'd hit that sort of philosophical bent in my life right about the time when I met Mike.
I think it was
a deeper part of me by that time.
Maureen, do you think Mike was testing you in any way, subconsciously, on some whole other level that he's not even aware of?
I don't think so.
Mm.
I don't think he had the conscious ability. I really don't. I feel that whatever happened that day came out of the blue.
Well, you talk about him going to that. What did you say? 31 times would have been a good title. Would have been a great title for the film, by the way. The number 31. But imagine what must have been dredged up from that experience.
Yeah, for him.
For him, yeah. The memory, the stuff that he wouldn't even. The tacit sort of awareness that would have been going on in his system emotionally and spiritually and all these things that, you know, you can't even put your finger on. I have no idea, right? So I don't know how we could ever have any kind of sort of comprehension of that.
I think that whatever happened in the ER that day activated a whole bunch of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot more nightmares after that.
Is that right, eh?
Yeah, and I think, you know, there were a fair number of nightmares when we first met, when he was just coming out of the, you know, recovery house, prison hell, right? But then they kind of went away. But after the relapse, they came back, and there was a lot of, you know, agitation, screaming out in nonsensical language, for, you know, quite a few months. It's diminished since, but I think it created a whole other, it was like just going back into a really bad time in his life again.
Right.
And, you know, I think a lot of, sometimes his nightmares are about his boys, about losing his boys. I think that's the dominant fear in his life, because the loss of them was almost too much to bear first time round. And I think that one of the reasons that he's so passionately committed to getting over the relapse quickly is to maintain that relationship with his boys.
What about your own sense of boundaries? You know, I mean, I guess this is a question, I guess, about that whole...
Why are you so smart?
I'm not sure. I read a lot of books. How's that? Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you. So yeah, no, but it you know, so many people wouldn't put up with this, right?
Well,
and I, you know, the whole sort of doormat philosophy, you know.
Yeah.
And
I'm not saying
that Mike treated you that way at all. I'm just saying he seems like an incredibly sweet guy. But it, most of us don't go there. That's what I'm, you know, as the international development guy, as the social justice guy, social change guy over here, trying to get people excited about places like Cambodia and Burkina Faso and literacy in Malawi, most people don't give a rat's ass after a certain point. Sorry for the cynicism, but it's true. You know, sure, I'll write you a $50 tax deductible check. Sure, I'll pin a picture of a sponsored child to my bulletin board or put it on our fridge, but we're not going to go a whole lot deeper than that. And I get why that is the case, but it frustrates the heck out of me sometimes.
Yeah, I understand that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not getting...
Yeah,
so there. I don't know. Do you have a screwed up sense of boundaries, Maureen?
you know what? To be fair, I think that people in my past and my dear friends might have said in the past, yeah, that I think that I was born with too much empathy on one level. I really do.
Wow.
And I've felt that it has caused me grief at some points in my life. What I have learned, again, from the community reinforcement and family training program, and also from a great therapist here, is how to create boundaries in this world. It's not about being a doormat. It is about saying, I'll give you an example. So Mike drank that first night really badly. And then there was like a night or two over the next couple of months, and I learned to say, you know what, because he's not the same person when that happened. Right? It's not pleasant. So I say, you know what, it's not a good time right now for us to talk. I'm going to go sleep in the other bedroom. It's not punitive, and it's not permanent. And let's talk up in the morning, right? I just keep out of the way.
Right.
And the next day, we went on a ferry trip over to Victoria to see our grandson. And we didn't talk about it until the way back.
Interesting.
And it's a way of like, why would anybody want to talk to anybody when they're drunk? Why would you engage, right?
And
it's kind of like a it's an exercise in stupidity. So these are the kinds of things I learned, and I also, one of the things I really want to talk about with you is this new website, addictionthenextstep.com, we got a $400,000 grant from the TELUS Health and Wellness Fund. And we created this site where, in collaboration with the Center for Motivation and Change in New York City, we created a site where we've got an online therapy tool so people can learn, craft. And it's as simple as we call it almost dial a dilemma. There's 20 scenarios. You pick the one that sounds closest to your situation. Help, my 17-year-old son is using again. He's on his way home. My husband wants to kick him out, says it's time for tough love.
Right.
I say no. What do I do?
Right.
You click on that scenario, and the tool takes you on this interactive journey to learn the new way of communication, to learn how to set boundaries, to keep all of these things in perspective while you get your child what they need. And in craft, 7 out of 10 treatment-resistant people will go into treatment after the family has been in for as little as 5 or 6 sessions.
Well,
it's not Al-Anon. It's not detached with love. It's stay invested with love and boundaries.
There's something that strikes me that's profoundly relational about that.
Even though it's a digital
platform. By the sounds of it, has it been released yet, or is that something you're in the middle of kind of constructing?
It's going to be released on January 21st.
Wow. Oh, okay.
And I'll send you the link.
Oh, please do.
So that, yeah. And, you know, we hope the Center for Motivation and Change, there was a great article on them in New York City. And we found them through a book they wrote called Beyond Addiction. And when Mike was getting well and we started writing the book, he would follow me around the house with this book going, it says here that blah, 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 blah. So we finally, when it got to the time to make the film, the CDC said there was a shortfall, not a huge, in the budget. They said, go to the TELUS Fund. They will put money towards the broadcast, but also give money for a digital tool. And Mike and I thought, what's really needed in the world?
Mm.
There's a lot of apps for addicts, but there's nothing for their families.
Support.
So they funded us. We're ecstatic.
That's amazing. It's amazing. It really is. Tell me a little bit about how, as a filmmaker, you've made a lot of movies over the years. You've been doing this for over 25 years. Is that fair?
I left the CBC permanently in 1999.
Okay. So you've had...
I was doing that kind of thing within the CBC for many years, yeah.
Have you ever had the experience of working so close to somebody you love like this?
No. No, it was really... It has been the hardest thing to do in my entire professional career, and I don't know that I could do it again or would do it again. It was really hard. Really, really hard.
What do you learn about yourself along the way? What do you edit out?
Oh,
that we didn't see.
Geez, like you ask really good questions. You don't see me in trauma. You don't see
me
really not knowing what to do next.
Mm.
You know, you don't see the muck because I don't think I couldn't have split my brain in two enough to know how to film that. Also, there is only 42 minutes, right?
Right.
And I thought, I mean, I need enough of a personal story for a dramatic spine that the CDC now wants. They wanted my perspective once the relapse happened, right? Because they felt an awful lot of viewers end up in my shoes. So yeah, that didn't make it in. And, you know, some really great science had to come out just because of the change in perspective. And, you know, I think in retrospect, you know, my partner Helen probably should have come in and done some interviews.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
You know, because
just
I was...
Just to bring a different perspective.
Yeah. Yeah, she, you know, when I had... And also, she was a godsend, as was Sue Dando, the exec at the CBC. You know, we sent her an early rough cut. And she sent back the most gracious, respectful, and provocative notes, right?
Mm.
And Helen did played a very similar role in the process, which, you know, made for a better film. Really challenged me.
The one of the things as a, I guess you could call, I'm a hopeful cynic. I'm a bit of an existentialist. I believe in, you know, freedom, choice, and responsibility.
Yeah.
And yet, I'm not this idea of dualism. The way we seem to acquiesce towards plus and minus, up and down, yes and no, and it, which is the antithesis of an embrace. It's the antithesis of inclusion. It's on the other side of finding the connecting points and the community and so on. And so anyway, all that to say, so I wonder, where would Mike say, if he was listening in, if he was a part of this conversation, would he say, you know, yes, this is a medical issue, it's genetic, it's nature and nurture, but you know what, I'm kind of culpable too, you know? I mean, there was a certain choice in there. I thought it was really interesting, the part where they talked about, was it his brother, talking about the root beer?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so they're talking about the root beer that ferments, and I mean, that's just... You know, pretty idle. That could happen to anybody. That's just one of those things that happened as kids, and all of a sudden you find yourself in a position that others aren't because of this predisposition.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
What would Mike say about that? That I guess that AA-like nature, and I'm not talking about shame or guilt here. I'm just talking about saying, you know what, I gotta buckle up here myself or ante up, you know?
Yeah. He would say it was very difficult to come to terms that he has a flawed brain.
Mm.
And he does believe that there is part of his brain that doesn't act like other people's brains. And, you know, we interviewed a great geneticist. He's not in the film. He's one of the people we had to cut out. And he actually is living on cbc.ca on the Nature of Things page about the genetic factors, right? And he said, you know, the biggest thing, we asked him what advice would he give Mike's boys.
Right.
And he said, well, you know, if I were one of your sons, I would recognize that there's a 60% chance that this is genetic. You are carrying a heavy genetic load.
Right.
And here's what I'd watch for. And he's done something. He did this amazing study, and I can send any of this stuff if you need it, David. Over 35 years, he followed 450 men whose parents had been alcoholics, one of them, usually a father. And what he found was that there are certain characteristics that all of these young men have that predispose them to having a drinking problem. And, you know, those characteristics are the kinds of things that Mike's sons need to be aware of. One of them is called being a low responder, which means very early in life, you can drink everybody else under the table.
Right.
So he says, Mike's sons, these are things you need to know. And if you're going to be a drinker, be a drink counter. Know that three is maybe where you should stop.
It's good.
So stuff that is, you know, puts in perspective that you have a severe genetic load, but you also have a choice.
You also have a choice, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not, this is an either or.
You know what, it's not early, you have a choice. Once you know, as I think I said in the film, if you do something 100 times in your computer, the computer doesn't change. But if you slam your dopamine receptors 10,000 times with booze, you have changed the structure of your brain. And then it's not about choice. You're hooped, buddy.
Yeah.
Your brain's going to do something else.
So there's a real practical side to a film like this. I mean, especially airing on a CBC, and then David Suzuki's Nature of Things. There's there's an ethos. There's a culture there, right?
Yeah.
So the thing that pops to my mind is the phrase that came out of the film about where doctors are sort of pushing AA without this better understanding. I will never forget Maureen going in, doing a test with my GP, and I'm sure I've talked about this on a podcast before, but 10 questions to determine whether or not I was depressed.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember getting done and going, really, are you kidding me? That's all you're going to ask me? Like, isn't there more to this? Like, it was just, he looked at it and he went, oh, I guess you're not depressed. And I went, well, actually, I've got some kind of experiential evidence over here to suggest otherwise. Anyway, you guys talk about medical malpractice.
Yeah.
And or at least somebody did in the film.
Yeah.
And I mean, is that one of your hopes with the film like this?
That's the key.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
one
of the key messages that we want to say. If the CMA and the American Medical Association consider it a disease, let's treat it like such.
Yeah.
Because when we do, we will stop the carnage. At least we'll make a dramatic dent in it, right? When you've got Columbia University's report closing the gap, saying the quality of most addiction medicine in the U.S. is akin to medical malpractice, when you have the head of the Betty Ford Center saying that he set up this foundation to prevent the harm being done by doctors to their patients, we don't have that sentence being said in the context of other life-threatening disorders. And that's the key message. And I've got something wonderful from Dr. Bernard LaFalle, who's the head of the Centers for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto. He sent me some pamphlets this morning, which, by all means, he wants out in the world. I'm going to put them on cbc.ca. They're pamphlets about the drugs that are now available. Some are off-label uses. They're early in research, and some are a lot further down the road in research. And doctors don't know this stuff. And Mike's clients will leave, you know, they'll leave his office and he'll say, ask your doctor for this, ask your doctor for that. They come back and go, my doctor says he's not even interested in talking about this.
Yeah, not
so
interested.
So now these pamphlets can go into everybody's hands.
Yeah, that's great.
These drugs need to be out there as widely used as heart medication.
Well, it's just interesting, you know, kind of coming full circle back to my question to you about the whole chronic thing, you know, I sometimes wonder if, you know, the medical community still sees, frankly, sorry for being kind of cliche, but they still see some of this stuff as either or. If you know, they don't, you know what? They don't see it as relational. So we got this one approach. If that doesn't work, well, you're screwed. Here's your Ativan.
Yeah.
Off you go.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, and I do think that, you know, that's, I guess, the second message in the film, which is we have a toolkit, an
right.
ever-expanded
yep.
toolkit.
Yep.
AA is certainly a part of that toolkit. It's a fabulous thing for so many people. But we just need everybody to know there are other options. And a lot of people don't know. And here's the really interesting thing. I think science is going to eclipse a lot of these arguments.
Mm.
There's a Dr. Anthony Phillips at UBC who's working on, it's a genetic, basically changing some of the way that receptors work in the brain so that, for instance, people who have to live on chronic pain medication, terrible back problems, they can actually, they hope, he hopes within a decade, to give those people another medication that will essentially short-circuit the ability to become addicted in the first place.
Right, right.
So these things are in the pipeline.
Wow.
I think that there's a lot of promise a decade or two from now. Right now, we're still in the weeds.
Well, it makes you kind of wonder, too, what other doors it will open medically as well with respect to, I mean, when I heard dopamine, I immediately thought other neurological disorders, Parkinson's and, you know, things like that. I mean, that's kind of connected, right? I mean, it's a pretty complicated place up there.
Really nifty research. Wish we'd had time to get it in the
film. Yeah.
It was at Cambridge.
Okay.
And we were filming in Cambridge. Parkinson's researchers found, they've been following a large cohort of people with Parkinson's.
Hmm.
When the disease causes the brain to deteriorate to a certain point, a decent, substantial number of their people they're following develop compulsive gambling disorders.
Wow, isn't that interesting?
So there is some connection.
So at least they
dopamine.
Might. So the message is that at least they might die rich. Is that what you're saying, Maureen?
What we're saying is that we just are beginning to understand the role dopamine plays,
yeah.
And that if somebody is suffering from an illness as devastating as Parkinson's can have somehow their reward circuitry hijacked, that's really not a choice they're making.
Yeah, exactly.
That was, to me, the most profound thing.
Wow.
Like, holy shit, if that's happening to people with Parkinson's, can we not see a continuum here for people who battle addictions?
Well, you know what? We've got to wrap it up shortly. I'm so sorry. Tell us what's Mike up to, in what's next for him, for you, for, you know, the book's coming out, the film's coming out.
What we're hoping to do, we haven't had time to organize it yet, we're going to go to Palm Springs in March.
Mm.
And on the way down, I'd like to drive and stop in Seattle, Portland, San Francisco, L.A., Palm Springs, show the film, and do a little bit of a book reading. The book is available as of February in the U.S.
Oh, okay.
So that's next.
Oh, good for you. Well, that's amazing. Well, thanks for joining us today. The film's called Wasted. It is premiering, I guess you could say, on CBC's Nature of Things, January 21st. There's a book called Wasted, An Alcoholic Therapist's Fight for Recovery in a Flawed Treatment System. The next step is the website. There's a lot going on here. I hope a lot of people get to see this film, Maureen, and I think it's going to continue to have quite the legacy.
I hope so. Thank you very much. I really appreciate a very enlightened conversation.
Thank you. Well, thanks for joining us today.
All right. Bye, David.